It's The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today it's a new book with new research that claims improving our willpower might improve our lives. For instance, give children a choice between one marshmallow now or two if they wait 15 minutes. Now, the ones who wait for two marshmallows will, in 30 years, probably be healthier, happier, and more affluent. Well, now that's an old study, but this new book claims willpower definitely makes for a better life. And by the way, you have to feed willpower. It runs like a muscle on glucose, and it gets tired. Well, stay with us for much more this hour on The Splendid Table. Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, sweetness and power could have new meanings because of the book Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. In it, research psychologist Roy F. Baumeister explains the links between glucose and self-control and between willpower and how we might change our lives. His co-author, New York Times science columnist John Tierney, joins us. John, good to have you with us.
Well, thank you.
So what did your co-author discover?
Well, he discovered that willpower actually is this form of mental energy and that it's powered by glucose in the bloodstream and that this actually is a store of mental energy that you use and that you deplete when you resist temptations, when you make yourself do something, when you exercise self-control, and even when you make decisions. All this depletes the same source of mental energy, and it depletes the level of glucose in your blood.
So you're saying that sugar is actually feeding my mind?
Well, in some sense it does. And in the laboratory experiments, they love to use sugar. They use lemonade with sugar, and the control group takes lemonade with Splenda. And they can't tell the difference, but the people who get sugar actually have improved self-control. Now, our advice is don't try this at home. Sugar, straight sugar, is not the greatest way to do it. You get glucose from just about any kind of food, and so we advise people to eat healthier foods that will do a longer extended release of glucose. You know, sugar works great in the laboratory because it's a very quick-acting thing. You go right up and down, and you can observe the effects right away, but it's not so great in your personal life.
Right. Well, you write that there are only two predictors of how we're going to turn out as people. I mean, this is psychologists talking, and that's intelligence and self-control.
That's right. It's amazing. You know, people with stronger willpower, that they do better in school and at work. They're healthier. They're wealthier. They're happier. Their personal relationships are better. Their children are more likely to thrive. And as you say, there are two predictors of these things. There's self-control and intelligence, and it's a lot easier to improve your willpower than to improve your IQ.
And there was a study now, this was back in the 1960s. Wasn't there a study that was done with children and marshmallows?
Right, and it was kind of an accidental finding that pointed the way toward this importance of self-control, where they would give children they would put a marshmallow in front of them, and then they would say that you can have this marshmallow if you want, but if you wait 15 minutes until I come back, I'll give you another marshmallow. And they were really interested in figuring out how do children resist temptations, what strategies do they use. And the ones that tended to work were the ones who looked away from it, not the ones who just stared at it. But then the researcher noticed later, because his children had gone to the same school where the kids did it, that the kids who'd been able to resist the marshmallow did so much better in school, and the ones who hadn't did worse. And that pointed the way toward the importance of self-control and achievement. And since that time, there have been lots more studies, much bigger studies. You know, one that just came out in 2011, they tracked kids for decades, thousands of children, and found that it predicted, you know, success in everything, whether, you know, between school, job, saving money, you know, staying married, you know, saving for retirement, staying out of prison. Self-control predicts so many good things in life. Mm. You know, but the real implication of this discovery that willpower is this finite resource you have. Now, it's like a muscle that you can actually strengthen it through exercise. In the book, we talk about different things you can do, like, you know, anything like just sitting up straight will strengthen your willpower over time. But at the same time, it's like a muscle. It gets fatigued as you use it during the day. So you have to recognize that you can't just count on it to get you through one crisis after another, that, you know, that if you're resisting a lot of temptations, if you're making a lot of decisions, all those deplete the same resource. And therefore, Roy has also found in some very interesting studies that the people with the best self-control, the ones who really do, you know, do well in a lot of things, are the people who aren't actually exercising willpower all day long. But they're the ones who structure their lives. They play offense and they avoid the need to do it. So, you know, they don't go to all-you-can-eat buffets. They don't bring junk food home and leave it sitting on the counter. They try to minimize the need for self-control. And therefore, when there is an emergency, when they face that tempting dessert cart at a restaurant, they have the willpower to resist it.
Okay, so I'm thinking dieting, because dieting is denying ourselves food, but you're saying we have to eat to supply the brain with the glucose to resist eating.
Right. It's a great, you know, dieter's catch 22, we call it, that in order not to eat, you need willpower. But in order to have willpower, you need to eat. And, you know, people beat themselves up for being overweight, and people tend to equate being able to control your weight with willpower. And there is a connection. People with better willpower and better self-control are better at maintaining their weight. But it's not nearly the strong connection there is with most other aspects of life, like doing well in school and at work and in your relationships and things. Because the body rebels against this. And if you try to starve it, if you don't give it any glucose, then your willpower declines. And the body fights back when it's being starved. So, you know, willpower will help you avoid temptations. It can help you establish good habits, you know, to avoid gaining weight. But it's not a marker. People who are overweight do not necessarily have weak willpower. It's the weakest connection that they've found in this.
So for someone who does want to lose weight, is there one piece of advice that you can offer them that will feed the brain and help them exercise that willpower?
Well, there are several things. You know, the basic step in any kind of self-control is to set a goal and monitor your progress and also strengthen your willpower. So you want to set a specific goal and set a realistic goal, you know, maybe 1 pound a week or something like that. And you might want to set a short-term goal, so it's over a month, 2 months, 3 months. And then monitoring your progress is really important. It used to be said, you know, they used to advise people don't weigh yourself more than once a week because you'll have these ups and downs and it'll discourage you. And which didn't really jive with the self-control research, because self-control researchers always found the more you monitored yourself, just kept track of what you're doing, the better self-control you would have. And they did a big study, and they found out that, in fact, people who weighed themselves every day were the ones who were most able to lose weight. And since I found out about that while writing the book, I've got this scale that, you know, that sends my weight electronically to my computer and my smartphone, and I see the grim news every day. But it did help me lose weight, you know, in doing the book.
Maybe all of us should find a Roy Baumeister. Hey, John, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
John Tierney is co-author with psychologist and researcher Roy F. Baumeister of Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. Well, I think my willpower will be nourished by this soup. It's a harvest black bean soup and a great one for a cold night. But I wanted to talk about it because it's an example of what sweet spices do for beans and cured meats and tomatoes. Now, in this recipe, for instance, you cook dried beans and vegetables with a ham hock, and then you add tomatoes. But the seasonings that you include are the ones you might use for an apple pie. They're cinnamon, allspice, ginger, and cloves. And I like to grind them fresh because they're really aromatic. They're so aromatic, they set off the whole soup. So try them. And try the recipe. It's Harvest Black Bean Soup, and you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. I'm lost out on the run, but I'll be back. somebody put the words food and truck or local and eats together, Jane and Michael Stern were tracking both. They reign over their site, roadfood.com, and they come to schmooze here. Jane, Michael, where have you guys been?
Hi, Lynn.
We've been to the state that I've been mispronouncing incorrectly for most of my life.
No, you've been mispronouncing it correctly. You've been pronouncing it incorrectly.
Yes, that's what I mean. Thank you. See, I'm completely flummoxed. Oregon, also known as Oregon.
That's the mispronunciation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But now I've learned to say the name of the state correctly, but I can't pronounce this town that we're going to talk about.
Yahats. Y-A-C-H-A-T-S. It rhymes with hots.
Okay, so that's why I've been going around saying Yachats, and
well,
nobody
Yachats
knows what I'm talking about. Okay.
Whatever. The point is, if you go there, there is one place. There are a lot of good seafood restaurants around there. I mean, the coast of Oregon is loaded with them. But one other type of thing that needs to be tasted in Oregon, especially along the coast, is good coffee. You know, Seattle gets all the credit for good coffee. Oregon has great coffee, too, and not only in Portland. The place that we're talking about is called the Green Salmon Coffee Shop, and it's right along the coast in Yahats. I know I'm going to get
or
correct.
Or Yachats.
Whatever. But the fact is, not only do they have terrific espresso and really great, interesting espresso drinks, like the Kopi Jahe, which is a double-strength
which I can't
coffee
pronounce either.
Well, let me just tell you what it is.
K-O-P-I-J-A-H-E.
It's a double-strength coffee infused with ginger and cane sugar.
Ooh, that sounds good.
It's wonderful. And then you can get a Cafe Oregonian made with hazelnut milk. You know, hazelnuts are big in Oregon.
Right,
Cafe
right.
Mexico with pepper, brown sugar, and cocoa. The coffees are great, but, you know, a lot of places serve good coffee. What Green Salmon has that many coffee shops don't have is really great food. I mean, really wonderful. You know, they bake their own bread. They make their own pastries. And if you happen to go there during berry season, what you want to get is something called triple berry toast. This is their own whole wheat bread, toasted, spread with a little mascarpone, topped with freshly picked blueberries, strawberries, and raspberries.
Oh, boy.
I mean, each just bursting with flavor.
With a great cup of coffee.
And drizzled. The fruits are then drizzled with honey and sprinkled with powdered sugar. With a cup of coffee, it's Oregon heaven.
You know, I don't know that people realize that Oregon and Washington State, these both are berry states.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And the berries are incomparable. Where is this in relationship to Portland?
It's south of Portland. I mean, Portland
and out
is
out on
a
the
bit,
coast, obviously.
It's on the coast, right. I mean, Portland is inland, and it's a bit south, not too far south. And it's right on route, what is that, 101, I believe, that goes right up the coast. And, you know, we just happened upon it driving up the coast. We weren't even directed there. But there's something kind of intriguing. What's so great about it is you walk in and, you know, coffee shops primarily dispense caffeine. And, you know, caffeine tends to make people somewhat jumpy and chattery. You
right.
walk into this place and it's like they're all meditating. There's something about it that's like very mellow and quiet and kind of easygoing for a place that sells coffee.
This sounds like heaven, guys. Thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Now, find information on their picks at splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back with the world's best cheesemonger and how to roast. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Rockfort and Gruyere and Slippery Brie, all of these cheeses, they happen to me. Oh, please. Pecorino and Moody Rams Hall, stop me before I just swallow it all. Oh, please. Somebody ring the cheese alarm.
Steve Jones is the best cheesemonger in the world. Now, that's official as of July 2011. Steve won the crown at the second annual Cheesemonger Invitational. Well, this raises two questions.
what is a cheesemonger and who is Steve Jones? Well, cheesemongering is a relatively new profession here, but an honored old one in Europe. And Steve Jones has worked in cheese for some 15 years, and he has the Cheese Bar in Portland, Oregon. Steve, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks.
Well, Steve, what does a cheesemonger do?
It's a multifaceted position for certain. Cheese care, obviously, is first and foremost. To buy and sell cheese as quickly as possible is our take on it. And to listen well to customers, I think, is probably the second most important thing, because they're going to tell you what they want, and you are then going to guide them to the right cheese.
You've talked, I've heard you speak about cheese, and you talk about doing triage with cheese when you get it into the store?
Right. Yeah, when cheese comes in, we receive cheese 6 days a week at Cheese Bar. And so you open up the boxes, and it's one of our favorite moments. We call it Cheese Christmas because you're pulling all these great cheeses out of the box, and everyone's a surprise, and some of them you've never seen before. Cheese is coming in from Germany and Belgium, and you're just totally pumped. But what you do is you open up those cheeses, and you're looking at them to make sure that the cheese isn't too wet, isn't too dry, isn't cracked, hasn't belled from sitting for too long. And what we then do is we assess these cheeses and we say, well, do we need to put our hands on these? Do we need to work on some rind maintenance? Do we need to get them into a different container? Do we need to dry them out a little bit? Do we need to wash them off a little bit? And then you assess them as to where is this a cheese you sell today, tomorrow, or maybe even next week. Some cheeses are going to have a little more life. Some cheeses are going to need a little bit of aging if we like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But there's these great people out there called affineurs, which are agers, and they do that job so well that I leave most of that work to them, and we have the fun job of just interfacing with the final customer.
All right, so the next logical question is, are these tricks we should know? I mean, if I buy a cheese, I'd love to be able to see it through your eyes, because then I can know, do I need to turn it? Do I need to know if it's belled?
Yeah, and a good cheesemonger should be able to help you with this, and I can definitely give you a few tricks, too. If you have a cheese that's belled, so a belled cheese, you can tell the bottom is bulging more than the top.
Right.
And so it's been sitting probably for up to 6 weeks on its trip over, if it's come from France or Italy. And so you can simply do that cheese a favor by flipping it over, because the gravity is pulled the weight and the fat and the moisture all down on that trip. So just by simply flipping that cheese over in a day or two, that's going to kind of redistribute through the cheese, and you're going to have a happier cheese. And also that bottom side, if it's been belled like that, quite often is going to have a fair amount of moisture and what we call diaper rash, where the bottom of the cheese is getting kind of gooey. And when you flip it, you're going to allow that to dry off a little bit.
So you have less chance of spoilage and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of other things you can do in your fridge at home. The main thing is I suggest you buy and eat your cheese as quickly as possible. That's your best bet. But if you do end up with something that does need a little love, other things you can do is pull off the label. If the cheese has a label right on its surface,
yeah,
it's not a terribly happy environment for that cheese, because that rind is a natural rind that wants to breathe. And most of those labels aren't perforated and aren't allowing that breathing to happen. So just removing that label, you've done the cheese a favor.
So does that mean, should your cheese be wrapped then? Should it be plastic wrapped?
Well, we highly recommend every piece of cheese that leaves my shop leaves in perforated cheese paper. And there's one out there that consumers can buy from a brand called Formaticum. And it's a French-made paper that's dynamite. It works really well. It'll add a ton of life to your cheese. It allows the cheese to continue to breathe without it suffocating and without all that moisture being stuck inside. So it'll add about double life to your cheese.
If I can't get that, could I perforate something like wax paper?
I would say, yeah, wax paper or parchment paper loosely wrapped around the cheese, and then tuck it into a Ziploc, because you're going to want to let the cheese breathe, but you don't want to let it in an environment that's going to dry out.
Ah.
So that Ziploc's going to keep your humidity up.
I see, because the refrigerator's a dry environment.
Exactly. A lot of air moving in there. and also a lot of different off flavors. If you have fish or anything else in there, your cheese will pick it up, just like butter picks up off flavors. Your cheese will do the same thing. That fat's a magnet.
So tell me about how do you become the best cheesemonger in the world? What was that competition about?
It was crazy. It was kind of equal parts rock concert, Wrestle Royale, and cheese dork extravaganza, loud music, bright lights. And so there were four elimination rounds. The first one was blind tasting. You had 10 minutes to taste six cheeses and try to give six descriptors for each one. And then the second round was precision cutting. So you had 30 seconds to cut two pieces of cheese off of a big 10-pound block down to a quarter pound each without a scale. And then the third was wrapping. So you had 30 seconds to wrap those two pieces of cheese in cheese paper. And then the last was presentation, where you got to bring kind of your A game on your presentation side. So I presented with them. Little cones that look like circus cones, red and white striped circus cones,
right,
full of bacon, caramel, popcorn, and a mountain cheese, and had those fanned out on a plate. And luckily, I came out on top.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn. It was great.
Steve Jones has the Cheese Bar in Portland, Oregon. He was named the 2011 Best Cheesemonger in the World. Now, when was the last time you had a cheese souffle? They're really easy. All you need is a few eggs, a good-tasting cheese, not a lot of it, and you're there. Sally Schneider has a fine recipe on the website. It's called simply Cheese Souffle. So check it out, splendidtable.org. Really enjoyable to read a good cook writing about cooking. You know, thinking onto the page as though she or he is hanging out with you in the kitchen, anticipating questions, walking you through recipes, you know, giving you some of the science behind the dishes. You can feel their pleasure through the words. Well, All About Roasting, A New Approach to a Classic Art, is this kind of book. It's the baby of cooking teacher and writer Molly Stevens. And Molly joins us from Vermont. Molly, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Lynn, great to be here. Thanks.
So, Molly, you wrote 573 pages on roasting. Why roasting?
Well, that's a good question. I think we tend to take roasting for granted. It's something we all do. It's such a basic method of cooking. You take some food, you season it, you heat up the oven, slide the food in, and you're roasting. And I really wanted to step back and think about what's really happening, and also what, you know, so you turn your oven to 350, so you turn it to 400, what's the difference? And for me, roasting, because of its simplicity, it's just such a direct, I like to say, honest way of cooking.
Well, you point out in the book that the first decision that you make when you roast is, do you use high heat or low heat? So how do you decide that?
Yeah, and that was really one of the first things I realized when I set out to do the book, was that it's not a one-size-fits-all method. And there are, I think James Beard said, there are four or five different attacks to roasting beef. And it's true about roasting just about anything. There are a lot of ways to go about it. So how do you decide? Well, high heat's great, and for certain things, it's the most aggressive. It's certainly the most exciting way to roast. You crank up your oven to 450, 500, 475, and it happens very quickly, and you get all these great seared exteriors. So it's best for things that you want to leave rare or medium rare, perhaps, or that you want a really crisp skin on, something that you want to be a little more gentle with, say a pork roast or a Thanksgiving turkey that's mm-hmm. too big. If you roast it at high heat, the outside might get done before the inside does, so
right.
then you want a more moderate heat. And then there's low heat, which does amazing things. It's almost like a barbecue, form a barbecue, because things just tenderize as they cook very, very slowly. All the juices stay in when you roast with low heat. So there's a lot of different, depending on the size of it, what it is. Is it a chicken? Is it a roast beef? The deli roast beef that we love, that's pink all the way to the outside.
Right.
You can only get that with you if you use low heat.
So if it's sort of a lean or tougher piece of protein or meat, then you want to do low heat.
Yeah, because the fat in a richer, like a rib roast or something, is going to insulate and help keep it juicy. So the high heat's not going to dry it out. But something that's prone to dry out, you want to go a low or moderate heat.
What about roasting vegetables? Which direction do you go in?
Vegetables, mostly high heat, but there are a few instances of – so I love like blasted broccoli is great. Just olive oil, salt, and pepper, put it in at high heat. It gets almost burnt on the edges, it's so, but the inside stays nice and tender. But then there are a few things like slow-roasted tomatoes or slow-roasted onions. One of my favorite is slow-roasted grapes, which take – and I mean slow, like 2 hours slow.
Wow.
But they maintain all their juices. It's the most amazing thing about slow roasting. You know when you pull something out after you've roasted it, and whether it's a vegetable or a meat, but they're juices that run out on the cutting board or on the work surface? When you slow roast, they don't run out. They stay in whatever you're cooking. Yeah. So these slow roasted grapes are almost – they're so juicy. It's like almost like an ice wine grape that's just been a little bit of the juices has evaporated, but the sugars are concentrated.
So then the next step is preparing the meat or the poultry for the oven. And you have a technique for salting that is really unusual. And I'd like you to explain it.
Yeah. And I've become a complete convert to this. It just makes such a difference, especially with meats and proteins that we cook past rare, shall I say. So with roast beef, if you're going to keep it rare or medium rare, it's not going to make such an impact.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're talking about poultry and pork, where we cook them to a point where they're still juicy, we hope, but there's not a real red center there, salting it ahead of time. And when I say ahead of time, I'm talking for a whole chicken a day, maybe 2 days. If it's something smaller, 6 hours maybe, but you need a certain amount of time for that salt to migrate all the way to the center of the chicken, the roast, whatever you're cooking. And the salt will just transform. It's amazing what it does in terms of enhancing flavor, texture, more tender, more juicy. And doesn't take – the question I get all the time is, well, won't it taste salty? Not if you do it right. You're not – we're not koshering it. We're not making prosciutto here. We're just adding enough salt as if you would season something regularly, but letting it sit.
You have to explain exactly how you do this.
Okay. So take the – let's go with the roast chicken. Take the chicken. Pull it out of the bag, take out the giblets, do whatever, get it ready, and then season it pretty generously with kosher salt. I use a formula of about a half teaspoon per pound, but and that's kosher salt, which is an important distinction because there's less kosher salt per teaspoon than table salt. And then slide it into the refrigerator, put it on a tray or something to catch the drips, and slide it into the refrigerator and leave it uncovered for a day or two.
Why uncovered?
Okay, when you come back, so the first, if you look at it in an hour, it's going to look wet. You'd be like, oh, what, you know, what's going on here? But if you wait and come back in 6 hours, 8 hours, a day, two, the skin will be, the salt will have disappeared. You won't see any trace of salt, and the skin will be taut and dry. And what that taut, dry skin will do in the oven when it's roasting is it will turn unbelievably crisp and brown, which is the goal of a good roast chicken.
Right. But one of the things you always hear about salting ahead is it's going to draw the juices out of the meat.
At first, but not – and this is why the lead time is so important, why I'm stressing anything over 6 hours, 8 hours, a day, 2 days. Because, sure, at first it will the salt will draw the juices out, but then those juices will be drawn back in along with the salt. And so now what you have is you have a piece of protein, a chicken again, that is seasoned – from the inside out, if you will, and not only seasoned so it has a nice savor to it, but the salt is the term, excuse the science term, but it's hydroscopic, meaning it hugs water. So the salt is going to hug the juices that are already in that chicken and make it stay juicier as you roast it. And the juices are the chicken's natural juices, so it's going to taste more like that good chicken that it is that you slid into the oven in the first place to roast.
Sounds pretty swell.
I tell you, trust me, this one is really makes a difference.
Okay, I'm going to give it a shot. Molly?
Okay.
Thank you.
Let me know.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Molly Stevens has written all about roasting, a new approach to a classic art.
That salting technique is definitely worth a try, as is Molly's recipe for ginger roast chicken and elbow macaroni with tomatoes and pan sauce. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. It is time to get in touch. The lines are open. We are talking with you. Anything goes. Call us, 800-537-5252. Follow us on Twitter. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Friend us on Facebook. Mary is on the line from Goshen, Indiana. Mary, what's on your mind?
Well, hi, Lynn. I bought a lamb at our county fair this past summer, and I have packages of something called lamb riblets.
Oh.
And I don't know what to do with these things.
Oh, they're fabulous. Oh, all right. This is from essentially the side of the animal. It's like the spare rib, essentially.
Okay.
Or coming down into the belly of the animal. And what you want to do is, this is the real low and slow cooking. And I've got a recipe on the website for them. I can't remember exactly what I called it, but the idea was that I lined a roasting pan with foil, and I trimmed off some of the fat because they tend to have a generous layer of fat on them. I separated them. I just cut, you know, and separated them a bit, not completely.
Okay.
And I put in, I think, wine and soy sauce and sugar and ginger and garlic and some star anise, which if you can't get, do not worry. You could just use anise seed or you could just leave it out. But I know there was a lot of fresh ginger, a lot of garlic. And if you like a little chili, you throw in chili.
Yep.
But the idea is here, I sort of, wrap them in foil with this liquid, cook them until they were very, very tender. Cook them very low, like a 225-degree oven. You could be doing that out on the grill with the lid down, literally wrapping them in foil, then uncovering them. And for me, I flipped on the broiler.
Okay.
And I crisped them under that, turning them, and they were really delicious. But the point was, first, I cooked them until the meat was extraordinarily tender.
Okay.
So you give them a bit of moisture.
Okay.
And tasty moisture, you know, so it could be apple cider, it could be beer, it could be wine, it could be barbecue sauce with something added to it that you know is going to be really tasty.
Okay, sounds good.
Oh, you're going to love it. This is, by the way, this is a cut that now is gaining popularity, and it's going to probably get really expensive, but it used to literally be thrown away.
Oh, my.
So if you run across it and it's cheap, stick it in the freezer. And I think it's going to go the way of flank steak. You know, flank steak used to be 99
right.
cents a pound, and it's now $13 a pound, which is a mortal sin. It is terrible. Enough. I'm off the soapbox. Enjoy the lamb ribs.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Coming up, more of your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, back to your calls. Let's talk. Lyle is on the phone, and he's calling from France. Lyle, hello.
Hi, Lynn. How are you doing?
I'm doing swell. Where are you in France?
Great. I'm actually in Paris right now.
Oh, you poor baby.
Yeah, I know. It's horrible.
I know. Hey, are you living there, or are you visiting?
Yes, ma'am. I've been here for 2 years now, actually.
What takes you there?
I am doing neuroscience, and there was just a really wonderful funding program to come over to Paris. So I took them up on the offer.
What a great opportunity.
Yeah, it was great.
So do you have a question?
Yes, ma'am. So I found myself on a really beautiful street here in Paris. It's a pedestrian street.
Yeah.
I got absolutely lucky when I first came to France. I didn't speak any French. I happened to randomly call a landlady, and she brought me onto this street. And anyhow, there's tons of markets, and I'm just kind of overwhelmed with choice. I was cooking a lot, you know, when I lived in America, but I was never a Francophile, so
right.
I was always cooking lots of Asian dishes. And I've cooked some good stuff here, but I haven't really found my, like, foundation. So I was kind of wondering if I could, like, give you a few ingredients, and maybe we could come up with something.
Sure. I'd be delighted.
Yeah, it's great. So I'm particularly intimidated by the seafood stand on the street, because they have things like sea snails, mussels, fresh scallop.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I've always wanted to be able to cook really good seafood, but I've never had the will to just jump in and do it, you know?
Well, boy, we can start almost anywhere. I'm just thinking of mussels.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Now, mussels are really fast. There's only one trick with them. Usually they come with a beard. They're sort of hairy things sticking out of the sides.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay.
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What you're going to do with mussels is you're going to buy them. You figure about a pound of mussels per person, because there's very little meat in each one of them.
Okay.
So for you by yourself, you might want about a half kilo. That's 1 pound. And what you'll do is you'll get them home and you'll run, just put them under cold running water and scrub them. And just take a knife and pull at those, they call it the beard, but pull at that sort of hairy black stuff and just cut it away.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, just to make sure there's no sand in them, you put them in a bowl. Cover them with some cold water and sprinkle some cornmeal or flour on them and stick them in the fridge for maybe an hour. And
right,
what happens
right.
is they purge themselves and any sand ends up in the bottom of the bowl. Then all you have to do is take a pot that they're going to fit in, put a little butter or olive oil in the bottom of the pot, saute some shallots in there or garlic, okay? And once you got the shallots or the garlic soft, add a little white wine, maybe like
wine,
a half a cup. Okay?
Right, okay.
Simmer that for a teeny bit just to get rid of the excess alcohol. Put in your mussels, cover the pot, and steam them over medium-high heat until they're open. And anyone that does not open, just toss it. Okay?
Right.
And you want them open about an inch and a half. You don't want them wide open because they'll be overcooked. That is it. Put that in a bowl. You take a good baguette.
You dunk and you eat,
and it is just fabulous. So that's where you can begin. And you can do that with cockles, and you can do that with clams. You can do that with almost any shellfish.
I can do that.
Yeah, you can do that. You can do that.
All
you
right.
can live off of that.
I also just wanted to say that when I first came here, I really appreciated your show because it kind of connected me back to the States. Between The Splendid Table and This American Life, I was, like, really connected back to home when I was really homesick. So thank you.
You know, it's good to hear that. I know what it's like to be homesick in a foreign country, and you really kind of need those connections. Check out the website, by the way, because there's a ton of information and recipe ideas on it, and a lot of them French-based, so it'll give you a quick orientation.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Hey, enjoy it. Take care. Bye.
You too. Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Dorothy's calling from Los Angeles. Dorothy, hi, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about granola.
Oh.
I make my own granola at home, and it tastes great. The only thing is I wish that it was clumpier or, you know, chunkier.
Right.
The only thing that I like about the store-bought kinds is that it's, like, got this nice lumpy, chunky texture,
and I can't
figure out how to duplicate that. And then I wonder, like, should I add corn syrup or something that would be stickier, but then it's maybe not as healthy, so...
Perhaps use a little maple syrup?
Yeah, that's what I'm using already. So what I'm doing is I have, like, the dry ingredients,
right,
and then melting a stick of butter, and then adding, like, a half cup maple syrup to that. So should I maybe, but then maybe it's not quite as sticky because it's mixed with melted butter. Should I add this
separately? I don't know. You know, I think you can pull back on the butter a bit. But what about boiling down the maple syrup so it's thicker?
Okay.
Any syrup has some element of water in it, right?
Uh-huh.
So if you can boil that down, then add it, then, you know, cook it with bake it with the granola, you should have clump.
Okay. And, like, right now I'm stirring it maybe baking it at 300 and stirring it maybe every 15, 20 minutes. Should I wait? And
yeah,
not
don't stir it as much.
Okay.
And,
okay.
And when in doubt, while it's still warm, you know, put something on your hand so you don't burn yourself. Scrunch it together.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that's not in the recipes, but when in doubt, scrunch.
Right. So then it will hopefully clump
yes.
together and stick together. Okay.
But if you cook down the syrup a bit, cut back on the butter,
okay.
I think you're going to be fine.
Okay. Great. I'll try it.
You do
thank
it.
Thank you. I
okay.
love your show.
Hey, thank
I'm
you.
I'm a podcast listener. It's great.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Bye. Claire is calling from Austin, Texas. Claire, what is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I have started making sweet potato oven fries.
Right.
And initially, I started making them because I thought my 9-year-old son would love them and eat them with ketchup. And the way it worked out is that he doesn't like them, but I do. And so I'm looking for other things to eat them with besides ketchup, some kind of sauce, or in possibly other ideas about seasoning, because I've just been using salt and pepper. So do you have any ideas?
Oh, dear. Let me count the ways. No, because this is the thing. Because they're sweet and they're so rich tasting, they can take almost any kind of seasoning. So I'll give you an instance, okay? We can go the Moroccan route. You toss them with a little olive oil, with the salt and pepper, and then you add cinnamon, coriander, cumin, and even a little garlic. You toss that, and you make your oven fries. Then what you can do is you can – now I'm not sure if the youngin' is going to want this, but you're going to love it.
Okay. Forget him.
We'll forget him for the moment.
These are for me.
Okay. So then this is what you would do. You could make essentially what's called a tremula, and it's a sauce or a marinade because it's used in a lot of ways, where you would put in a food processor olive oil, fresh lemon juice, garlic, fresh coriander, and in this case, fresh mint – and a little honey, so you have a sweet sort of tart take. And if you want something hot and spicy, like fresh chili, and you'd puree that together, and you get a thick sauce out of that, you roll those babies around in that, and you are going to be in heaven. I mean, or just dip into it and stick it in the fridge, because you can marinate stuff in that. You could, you know, thin it down and use it as a salad dressing. That would be just fabulous.
That does sound yummy.
Yeah. And, you know, then you could go with the fries. You could go with the fresh ginger with the garlic and the chili route. You toss it, you know, with some oil and the fries, so that'll help it stick to the fries. And you eat that with fresh lime juice on it when it comes out of the oven. That's sort of an Asian take. And then you could, you know, then you could go to Italy and you could do lemon zest and fresh rosemary and fine chopped onion and olive oil. And you're down another path.
That sounds good, too.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying? I mean, we could sort of travel the world with those oven fries. And somewhere along the line, your child may actually be curious enough to give it a shot.
That's what I hope for, but I'm not going to wait around on him.
I don't think you want to hold your breath, but try these. See what you think.
I will. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Bye.
Megan is on the line from Minneapolis. Megan, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. It's so great to speak with you.
Well, it's good to talk to you, too. What's on your mind?
Well, I need your help in finding a use for infusion leftovers.
Infusion leftovers.
I don't know what else to call it. So I have made a sour cherry liqueur by macerating fresh cherries in vodka. And so after I strained the fruit from the alcohol, I'm left with these really boozy cherries. And I don't really know what to do with them, but I can't bring myself to throw them away.
Oh, you can't throw them away.
I know.
Well, you know, a couple of things. Okay. Now are they, they've got pits in them and whatever, right?
No, they're pitted. They're already pitted.
Oh, you are classy.
Yeah.
You're really classy. And they're really tart, right?
Yeah, they're really tart. And after they've come out of the vodka, they've lost a significant amount of their cherry flavor, but they're really taste strongly of the alcohol.
Oh, you know what would be great to do with them? Cook them into a pan sauce, you know, at the last minute.
Okay, so, that sounds great.
I mean, you know, you've done some lamb, you've done some salmon. You need something with a little bit of fat. You know, something.
Okay.
You know, this isn't the thing to serve with a super duper lean piece of fish. If you've roasted a chicken, Okay, you throw them into the pan where the roast chicken was, and you stir them around, and you make a pan sauce. You know, you put that pan on top of the stove, and you add maybe a little bit of pomegranate juice or something like even apple cider, and then you throw the cherries in there. So you get fruity, and then you get that wham of the cherries, and you cook them so you get some of that alcohol off.
So, that sounds great. Well, I can't wait to roast some meat tonight and make a pan sauce.
Hey, and it just occurred to me, the word roast. How about roasting them with roasted vegetables?
That seems very seasonal.
Ooh, that would be perfect. Beautiful.
The rutabaga, beets.
You got it. Exactly.
I like that.
Exactly. And roasted some yams with those. I think they'd be great.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Lynn.
You are really welcome.
Appreciate your help.
You take care. Bye, baby.
Bye-bye.
800-537-5252. Lisa is on the line from Van Nuys, California. Lisa, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lynn, how are you doing?
I am doing pretty well.
Good.
What are you thinking about?
Well, here's the dilemma I have. I have a small, well, not so small, I guess, a key lime tree in my backyard, which I thought was great.
I think it's pretty great, too.
Yeah, it's great, except it's producing so many limes, I literally don't know what to do with them. I've given them away. You can only squeeze so many of them into an ice cube tray and save them. And then my friends, I'm like, what can I do other than key lime pie or lime curd? And I was trying to think if there was something more savory I could do. I'd gone online and tried to research, like, chutneys maybe. Couldn't really find anything with key limes, and then it occurred to me that you hear so much about preserved lemons, and I was wondering if you could preserve the limes.
I have never tried preserving limes with salt and acid, and you can use spice. But why not? If you've got a ton of them, why not do a couple of jars?
Yeah, they're very tiny, you know. So
yeah, I know. Key limes are really tiny, and they have a really delicious quality to them.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? And the other thing is, why not peel a bunch of them? You know, just take the peel off. Just take a vegetable peeler and freeze the peel. And that way you can grind it up, you know, in a food processor. You can do whatever you want with it, but that peel will be delicious as a flavoring. And and there's another thing. I remember, I mean, when you talk about savory uses, there was a chef I knew in Belgium. He had a 3-star restaurant. And he did this incredible rabbit dish. Now, you could do this with anything. You could do this with fish or with chicken or with, you know, my favorite thing is always I fool around with yams at this time of year.
Oh, yeah.
You hear, you know, Lynn is always talking about yams. But you deglaze a pan, you know, after you've done any kind of pan sauté where you use the pan juices and you melt a little honey in there. And then you have the fresh key lime juice and a little chopped chili and salt and pepper. And if you want to go the Southeast Asian route, a few drops of fish sauce.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, one of my tricks that I like to do is I slice up about a quarter inch thick yams, just boil them. They take 10 minutes in salted water. And then that kind of mix just gets poured over them, and I serve them as a salad.
Wow, that sounds great.
I mean, it's dynamite. Yeah. And a little fresh coriander on that, the green chilies chopped over it, and the key lime tastes...
like it's spicy.
Yeah.
And can you recommend any good chutney recipes?
Well, take a look at some of the green tomato chutney recipes, but use the lime instead. Because green tomatoes are really acidic. They're not sweet. And I would cut back on some of the seasoning so you get the taste of the lime.
Yeah.
But what you want is the lime and the sweet sour with a bit of spice.
Just a little heat. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Lynn. That sounds great.
One other thing, by the way, one other experiment. Scoop out the flesh. In so many words, take the whole chunk of lime flesh. Mm-hmm. Coat it with some sugar and leave it in a glass bowl overnight. And see what you get, because the sugar will permeate that, and you might get a nice sort of almost a candied lime pulp kind of an effect.
I like that.
And that might be kind of interesting to chunk up and put over sorbet, or just puree as a sorbet.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah,
well, thank you.
I think we better quit now.
I think we got to quit now. I'm getting hungry already. All right. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Now, you know you can connect with us any way you want. You can call us 800-537-5252. And you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this from George Bernard Shaw, who said, "Vegetarians claim to be immune to most diseases, but they have been known to die from time to time." SplendidTable.org has just about everything you will ever need. And if you love what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. And for a daily dose of food inspiration, make sure you're following us on Instagram and Pinterest. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.